hardly smoke at all when I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, but when I get like this, I smoke less than one of these a day, but I smoke about five since I've been here. I've just lit my sixth, and the Admiral's going on to tell the story about a conversation with Harry DeWolf.
Oh, one day we had a steaming away from the shoreline, and Harry and I were together, and there was a most god-awful flash. I guess it was just after dark in the stern of his ship, and I thought, Harry, there's poor old Harry. He's had it this time. He's had a good war, and he's had it. I've never seen such a flash. I was only about two cables behind the stern. And the after gun was still hot, you see, from the actions.
And it cooked off.
And it cooked off. And it flashed back. I think did Harry ever tell you? I guess he killed seven or five people at the gun's crew.
No.
But it made a most frightful flash.
But the breach, you know, it did, eh? And so his own gun's crew were killed.
His own gun's crew were killed.
Must have been X-gun, a
Y-gun. Y-gun, X-gun or Y-gun.
Yeah.
And I thought she'd had it. I thought she'd been hit, really, this time. And I think he only lost six or seven men in it.
Yeah.
And I just had to mention that because that was very clear. Because most of my night actions, Harry had gone home by the mine, went home in July.
Yeah.
And then I went on in that channel thing. And Rayner had gone home early too. They both left that time. And I forget who relieved them. I can't remember. I'm not sure Harry didn't take Kaida back with him when he went back. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Because she, about that time, needed a refit. But I want to say this. You know, little things that matter. I'd like to read them to you sometime. Iroquois took such a fancy of the actions. Now, see, Iroquois was named after the Iroquois, of course. And they took such an interest in our ship. And this was arranged by my own sailors. I don't know who arranged it. I was sent up to be made an honorary chief Gonwagoa. I'm an honorary chief. I was adopted by the Six Nations of the Grand River.
Spell it?
Six Nations of the Grand
River. No, I can spell that.
What's
your name, your Indian name.
I'm Chief Gonwagoa. G-A-W-A-N-G-O-W-A.
Yeah.
I'm named after Pauline Johnson's father. And funnily enough, Pauline Johnson was a friend of my father's. They didn't know that when they named my name. And I'm named after Pauline Big Boat. Gonwagoa means Big Boat. And it was a very dignified and lovely ceremony up there. And they planned all this. I knew nothing about it until I was asked to go. And I stayed with Senator Ross McDonald. And Senator Ross McDonald, in his house, you see, and Mrs. McDonald was so sweet, and Senator was so sweet, and she said, we've never had an admiral in the house, and I said, well, I've never stayed with a senator.
Yeah.
And we had he held my hand and told me where to go, and they put on a ceremony. I've shown you a picture.
I've seen those pictures, yeah.
And it was a most dignified ceremony, and then we had to give speeches that night. It was 1944, I guess, and Armistice Day in 1944 when this took place. And the sailors, God bless them, that's where the inspiration comes from, your people you serve, if you will. And they had planned all this without my knowing about it until I got this message to be adopted by the Six Nations of the Grand River. And then they had a sailors, a seaman's mess in Brantford. And
Brantford, Ontario.
Yes, this way the home of the Nations of the Grand River. And but they had taken such an interest, and they very seldom adopt anyone. They have very few. I saw the book of the people they had adopted. On the same page was the Prince of Wales when he was adopted in 1918 or something. I mean,
picked them.
The world champion plowman had been done before me.
Who?
The world champion plowman.
The Prince of Wales, the world champion from...
I remember those names.
And the Emperor of Saint-Jean-de-Luz. Big boat.
But they used to send us reindeer waistcoats, you know, things like that. But they've taken such an interest in this ship.
Yeah.
And, they were great. All right, Chatlock. How's that?
Oh, that's good.
What worries me a little bit, you're doing this, I understand, for the history of the Navy, aren't you?
Yeah.
I just hope that we have a lot of people see what occurred, what the situation was at the time. The historian, I have the greatest respect for historians, but in all due respect, he researches the written word. He researches the written word. And who got down to write after a night action? They were tired. They needed half an hour's head down. Nobody really wrote much. There were a few people. The pen, I know, is mightier than the sword. And sometimes the pen has outdone the sword in bringing out the story. That's what really a concern to me. And I just hope that those people that didn't write will be heard.
Would I be correct if I paraphrased what you said this way? If your sword hasn't done very well that night, the pen might make up for it?
That'd be fair enough, I suppose.
You'd agree with that?
I think so, yes.
Yes, because there's a lot of that in the written reports. And I agree with it. When I wrote my monthly report of proceedings to Admiral Bidwell, I didn't sit down to prove what an ass I had been the previous month.
No.
I mind you, I wasn't, but I did make mistakes, and if I didn't think he already knew about them, then I didn't mention them.
No, I see.
Well, I think we're all like that.
Yes, you know, some of the things that really went on, the story, it had to be lived to be understood. And I just hope the historians can get themselves back to live what was happening at that time, what was going on at that time, the conditions at that time. And, you know, it's some of the things I've even said now I would never repeat that I've told my own men. You know, when you get, you're very stirred up in this battle. And they're little inclined to want to pick up survivors when they shouldn't be, and things of this nature. And you'd say things that you'd never repeat in peacetime. We were there to survive.
Well, you can repeat them in the confidence of this tape. There'll be
I've told my men.
There'll be you, me, and the historian.
There's nothing better than a greasy German for a good thrust block. And you know, you didn't stop to pick them up.
Nothing better than a greasy German
to oil up your thrust blocks.
Yeah.
These are things you don't use. I don't like talking about that.
But still, these things are said, and it gives people that didn't live it a feeling of what it was like to be there.
Let me tell you the sequel to that, though. Right now, I remember it's at Venice Park, at Baden-Baden, a few years ago, and I was having dinner at that beautiful hotel, Venice Park, and the menu was in German. And the man leaned over from the other table and he said, can I help you? And I picked my menu, beautiful dinner. About half an hour later, the head waiter came in. This is when the music was going. You had a lovely place to sit down while you were preparing for dinner and having a drink. And the head waiter came in and said, Admiral, your table is ready. You know, rank impresses head waiters. It doesn't impress me very much, but impresses head waiters and hall porters. Yeah. And they love using it. So this man picked up the ears and said, oh, I was in the Navy during the war. Are you a sailor? And I said, yes. Oh, he said, I said, where were you? He said, I was in Norway. What are we doing? I was in submarines. I said, you weren't there at the time at 43, Christmas 43. Oh, yes, he said, I went out to attack that convoy in Christmas 43. And that was, he'd been out to attack me when I was going through with the Scharnhorst in Christmas Day, 1943. And now, you know, there was a report right away. And I loved that man from that moment on.
Yeah.
Now, he's extraordinary. He was just great. We went out to this casino that night together. We saw each other the next day, and he left after that. But what is it? There we are. I had great respect for the German forces. Great respect for the German Navy and the German submarine Navy. And here this man just happened to hear I was a sailor, and we clicked just like that.
It's a nice story, that.
It's
a heartwarming story, that.
That's why you don't... It's extraordinary how things go on. I wish we could find the solution to our problems today. That type of thing could go on, I'm sure, between the Russians and ourselves. If we met, I respect a Russian sailor just as he respects me. A doctor will respect a Russian doctor. The different walks of life.
Yeah.
If we could bring out something, we've got to do something different to think we're going to control weapons. I won't get into that now. But
no.
The control of weapons is not going to be the answer to our problem.
What is then?
It's a political decision. It's a goal between our nations. Communications.
Yeah, that's what Mr. Trudeau is trying to do now.
And he may not be doing a bad job. He'll be very heavily criticized for this. I read yesterday at lunch, I read his speech. Somebody, actually, Reg Lane, brought his speech to lunch yesterday and is analyzing it for our lunch next week. This is our roundtable lunch.
Yes.
And there's a lot of good thinking in his speech.
Yes.
See, none of us trust Trudeau's the trouble. And we're all worried as to, is he doing this for some political reason? But he thinks not. He studied the speech, and he's doing analysis.
Reg Lane thinks not. Yeah.
He thinks this could be a very... he doesn't know it'll succeed. That's not my question.
No.
My question is, it may be quite... let's give him credit that it's sincere.
Well, I think we should do that. Unfortunately, he was criticized in... New York the other day by mostly NATO officials.
Yes.
They said he hasn't paid his dues to the club.
He hasn't. His record from the defense point of view is simply awful.
Well, it's the same as every other Canadian prime minister's record.
Yeah, terrible. But he did take us out of NATO, or half of us out of NATO.
Well, he cut our contribution,
He cut our contribution to color. It's enough for one day.
Here we are again on Monday the 28th, another nice sunny day. You had just finished the last tape by telling us about your meeting with the U-boat commander in Baden-Baden, but chronologically we're up to your time back in Canada when you become Captain D. Halifax. Would you go on from there, sir?
Yes, I arrived to take over Captain D. Halifax 2 days before VE Day. 2 days before VE Day. And that was remember the upset in Halifax. They called the VE Day riots in Halifax, and they were. It was a sad day. It was a sad, sad day. Sailors had not been too fond of Halifax during the war years, and the Haligonians had done their best, but it was a difficult period, and we piled thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, into Halifax. And they'd had quite a war, too, Haligonians. And we found ourselves arrived at VE Day, and it was a day of celebration. Now, I'm not going to cover that, I don't think, the VE Day riots. It's been so thoroughly done by Mr. Justice Kellogg, I think.
Yes, Kellogg did a book. And there's a new one out called Open Gangway, written by an Air Force officer.
I could go on. That was a...
I think that's been covered.
That's
enough.
Been well covered for the record. I don't think I'll say more than that. That Captain D's ships, my ships, bless their heart, showed up in the report a little bit better than the Stadacona. In that, it was a little easier for me. As soon as I saw trouble in town, I went right down to my office and phoned every ship and said, anybody bring good loot into the dockyard, get their name at the... get their... what ship... all you have to get what ship at the gate, and I plan for my duty officers to meet them beautifully at the gangway.
Yes.
That was easier for the Navy to... for the ships to do it, but it was hard for the civilians. It was sad to see Admiral Murray going around Halifax in the back seat, with the mayor, shouting to sailors to get back to their ships. And
he did that, did he?
Yes. It was a sad, sad day. Too bad. And I don't know whether it was there are mistakes made, but I'm going to leave that to the historians who and leave that. I won't give my opinion on it. I think a little, the city of Halifax could have opened the up a little bit, opened the liquor vendors and
yeah, and the restaurants and the theaters.
Yeah, everything was happened.
On the other hand, the admiral had been running a war, and he had rather got out of. He just didn't have time to be a divisional officer to all the men in Halifax. But
no.
It has always seemed to me, as a personal opinion, that it's the duty of any admiral's staff to keep him informed on what the feeling is around the admiral, because he's putting in more than a 12-hour day every day. And I don't think Admiral Murray realized the full extent of the bitterness of the sailors towards Halifax.
No, possibly
and I
not.
I put that down to his staff not keeping him informed that this might happen. Also, to bring our two lives together for a moment again, I was first lieutenant of Sioux, and we were one of your ships when you were Captain D, and there was not one man in Sioux in those riots.
Good.
So this backs up what you said a moment ago.
I think the ships showed up well.
Yeah.
I think the ships, some of them were ashore and some of them got a little into trouble, but it was nothing serious.
Well, some came back drunk, but
oh, yes.
The day ignored that. We just got him lashed up in his hammock.
No.
We used to lash him in.
Yes,
sir. So there you are as Captain D. The riots have... But this must have sparked in your mind again, it had always been there, the necessity of a good relationship between the civilians and the Navy.
Oh, that's been very close to my heart all my life. And I think we as a service fail to realize this. I'm sorry that in the years gone by we had not integrated with the civilians enough. And I could give example after example where I have thought that in the back of my mind, and I've worked at that ever since those days.
Yeah.
We lived for ourselves too much.
Well, as too much then, and Peter Newman says in his most recent book...
Well, I haven't read that yet.
Well, I've got a copy that he gave me. I'll lend it to you. It's called True North, Not Strong and Free.
Yeah.
He says, and he's a commander in the reserves now...
Yeah.
He did his UNTD time, something which you started. He said, I'll get the exact quote from the book, but he says, most of the military senior officers think that their main problem is that the civilians don't understand them.
Okay.
And you can infer from that and neither do the senior officers take enough trouble. They take some, but they don't take enough trouble to let the civilians understand them. Yes, we show the flag. The band looked glorious, by the way, yesterday at the Grey Cup game, didn't it? Danacona and the Naden naval bands in their sailor's rig playing Heart of Oak. My gosh, was there a lump in your throat?
There was
a lump in mine.
But this is where the quite a sage remark to say, civilian doesn't understand. He doesn't understand the importance of certain things which are intangible. They're probably hard to understand. Unless you've lived something, how can you? If you lost a child, died, how can you explain that to anybody unless you've experienced it yourself? The real lessons in this world are your own experiences. It is two people I've learned that from so dearly, so much. Buck Chisholm, I used to ask him what education was. And he'd say, it's the art of living with your fellow man. That was his definition of education. A friend of ours, who was the top psychiatrist to North America, to Canada as well as the United States, I put it to him. He said, it's your degree of maturity. Education is how mature you are.
Would we know that psychiatrist's name?
Yes, Dr. Blaine. Lived in Washington. And he was top psychiatrist for North America. And
just for
visiting us here in Victoria.
Just for the record. Fine. Just a moment.
That's why I started the Armed Services Center here.
Yes.
That's way ahead of time. That's later on.
Yeah, that's a little later on. So... Yeah, I know what I wanted to you to comment on.
Captain
Peter Newman says that's still the problem with the senior officers today. Have you any feeling for that? You have weekly meetings, don't you, with this luncheon group of yours downtown. Yeah. Reg Lane is one of them. Who are the others in that luncheon group?
Well, Judge Osler.
Judge Osler, yes.
Bill,
is that Bill Osler?
It's Bill Osler.
Oh, I know Bill.
And Perman of Lindholm, who's done a lot of labor law.
Well, how do you spell his name?
P-E-A-R-L-M-A-N. Dick Bauer, the editor-in-chief of The Colonist. These are the same five. We started this 10 years ago. And
you meet...
We have a guest every week, too. We should often get over... we've had the premier 4 or 5 times. We have guests, and we just trying to understand the problems. Nobody holds forth as what the answers are.
No, what's going on?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But now we're back to Captain D.
Yeah, fine.
After the VA deaths, I won't go into the VE Day riots because that's been well documented. But I'm just going to say a few words about the explosion of the magazine there. At the time after VE Day, all the ships in the Atlantic were coming to Halifax. Here I was, Captain D. Every ship was coming to Halifax. Now you can imagine trying to decommission ships, prepare for the war in the Pacific, get the ammunition and refit ships, organize all the ships that were going to the Pacific. That's the time the chief of naval personnel flew down to me and asked me if I would take the flotilla out to Japan. And I was very honored at that, but Japan, the war had ended. I was never appointed to take it, to this appointment, but he asked me if I would go and take the flotilla to Japan. Now, we were getting ready for the Pacific War, demobilizing, paying people off. And one of the tragedies of that time, there's two things that stand out so clearly in my memory. One is the seriousness of when they came back and I flew to Ottawa and I said, now you have got to take firm direction up here and tell these men what they should do. Who goes to the Pacific? Who stays? Who's demobilized? You cannot. A decision like this, how could a man turn to his wife and say, I'm not coming home, I'm going to the Pacific, when the government of the day says...
You have a choice.
You have a choice. Now, this doesn't mean much to a man in Ottawa, Bob, but he doesn't understand this, bless his heart. You know, forgive them, they don't know what they do when they say a thing like this. You've got to be... This is a decision. It's a very, very difficult decision. He doesn't know how serious the war is, how long the war is going to last in Japan. Doesn't know what to do about him, a thing like this. Should he get back and reestablish himself in life? Or should he get back? I flew to Ottawa and told them this. And I went with the minute with George Jones, who was then Chief of Naval Staff, and I went into the minister's office, and I said that.
That was Angus L.
Angus L. And George G.C. Jones said, oh, they'll be told. Of course, they weren't told. And that the volunteering Pacific, now this is something that should be on the record, very tight. We could have had riots at that time on this Pacific War. I had to fall in, tell every one of my captains, I would court-martial if I heard him criticize the government. And I was as mad at the government as he was. But I had to take a firm stand then, a very firm stand. They were furious as to what to do. Put yourself in that position. You were in that position, weren't you? What do you do? And I don't think that is one thing that breaking down of respect for authority. There was a definite breaking down of respect for authority.
A civilian authority or naval?
Civilian authority.
Yes.
Civilian authority. The second thing in that period, very upsetting, was rushing to get people demobilized. I know it was important, but I had to tell Ottawa, you cannot do this. There's no way you can do this efficiently. The ammunition was piled on the jetties. It was piled outside the magazines. It was just trying the impossible and being pushed by the government. I have on record in Ottawa, signal after signal, this is not possible. Something is going to happen. By God, it did. When the magazines blew up. And the magazines themselves didn't blow up. It was the ammunition outside the magazines that blew up. And that was covered up by the government unbelievably. They certainly made a big splash of the V-Day riots, but the cover-up of the ammunition was entirely the inefficient de-ammunition of ships was a tragedy, which was Ottawa had to accept the responsibility for that, having been told by me three or four times, you're in serious trouble if you go on like this.
Yes.
You remember, were you there at the time of the explosion?
Yep, I was. I was married that night.
Were you? Oh, God, what an exciting night.
As Alma and I said, I do, there was another boom. And good. My best man said, there's a sign from heaven.
Well, I went down to the dockyard. I found myself in command in the dockyard because my brother, Commodore Hibbert, was down in Sydney. And Admiral Jones, Admiral Murray had been relieved of his command.
As rapidly as that, now.
He'd been relieved before that, because he had to be there. And GC was in Ottawa. So I found myself, and that's when I got on the radio and evacuated the north of Halifax.
Yes.
You remember we evacuated the north of Halifax?
I do.
I rang up Enos, I said, get out of town as fast as you can. Yeah. And we sat up all night there with the, that was a heck of a night. I didn't like that. That was a bad, bad business. And, however, we had another Royal Commission on that. I just finished the Royal Commission on V Day riots when I had to sit through the Royal Commission on the ammunition.
So that's on record, and it's on record here.
No.
That the rapid demobilization, because of the government's decision that Ben could go home, I was trying to get a ship ready for the Pacific as First Lieutenant of Sioux. Jumbo Weber hadn't yet joined.
Yes.
And I went through three ships' companies in numbers in a few months. I'd no sooner get a man than he'd go on demob leave.
Yeah, yeah.
It was impossible to get ships ready for the Pacific. Yeah. But anyway, that's just to back up your previous remark. There's two Royal Commissions you've sat on.
Yeah.
And now you're Captain D of Halifax. The riots are over. The ammunition is fires are being put out. And what now?
BJ Day came and it went by very nicely.
Yes. I think Ken Adams had a lot to do with that. He was given Naden, wasn't he?
Yes.
Stadacona.
Stadacona, yes. And he gave free beer, and he got all the girls into Stadacona, and he had free beer, and, you know, I suppose the...
Well, there was no reason to go ashore.
No, good food, eat, sleep, and propagate.
Three basic laws.
They had a great time.
So that went by...
My chief of staff rang me up and
who was he?
From Montreal, oh dear. I forgot my... It just cut to me a second. Without any giving any thought to these tapes, and Pratt, who was my training commander, both rang me up and said, we quit. And I said, you sound to have more liquor than I have, I'll be right around.
So now you're Captain D's time when everything is quiet and VJ Day
never
is
quiet.
Over.
Never
quiet, but not exploding and not rioting.
No, that's right.
Now, how long there, and what did you do?
On Christmas Day, I was appointed on 25th of December to Deputy Chief of Naval Personnel.
There's nothing else about your Captain D's time.
Well, I don't think so. I think there were 20,000 men came under me at that time. All the ships in the Atlantic came to Halifax. I believe my chief of staff told me one day we have 20,000 men to consider here. They came directly under Captain D, with all the ships at sea in the Atlantic and elsewhere were coming into Halifax. So we had lots to do, put it that way.
Then we're getting up to the 1st of January 1947 when you're confirmed captain. From acting captain
Well, 46, all the time I was 46, 1946, I was DCNP. I went to Ottawa on Christmas 45.
21st of the 12th, 45, to Bytown as an acting captain. That's right. So now you're DCMP. Fine.
Yes.
All right. As DCMP, what did you do?
I took over that on Christmas 1946. 45. And I was all 46. DCMP, I was deputy chief of naval personnel.
And the chief was?
Paul Earle.
Yeah.
From Montreal.
Yeah.
Was CNP. And only for a short time. And at that time, we were looking to the future Navy. And Paul Earle was CNP. D.C. Jones was CNS. I was DCNP. And we were getting ready to organize the Navy for after the war and bringing in, transferring, the big period during that time was transferring officers from the reserve wartime officers into the permanent force. And I sat on board after board interviewing officers to join the Royal Canadian Navy at level that they could come in at and their experience and age. And we set a chart what if they're a certain age and so on. Now that was a big move at that time to get officers with war experience into the service, permanent name, and I think many will remember those days. Hundreds and hundreds were transferred to the Royal Canadian Navy, and we were more than that. Now, what's your question on DCNP?
There was that. You had to do what else?
Oh, we had all training comes under CNP, of course, so that came under me again. At that time, we were reorganizing the reserve in Canada. That's when we wrote the orders for reorganize the Royal Canadian Naval Reserve. And we built that, started the divisions. I remember picking the headquarters. It was Jimmy Hibbert who chose Hamilton as the headquarters. I did it the way, I put my finger on the map, and that will be the headquarters of the Royal Canadian Naval Reserve.
Well, it's a good central spot, and it's on the water.
And, yes. And we set up the organization for the Royal Canadian Naval Reserve. Now, that was a big step. We set it up and did what we call a complement. I was chairman of a complement committee. That's the establishment of every ship and establishment. So we set up, we set that position up as an admiral at that time. And it used to come under, it was one man. I was in charge of the Royal Canadian Naval Reserve when I DCNP. Mm-hmm. It was one position. Mm-hmm. And I said, I can't do my own job, let alone do both. And that's when I created the position of Naval Reserve, yeah. Made it a Commodore and then made it an Admiral.
Yeah. Well, it was a directorate then, Director of Naval Reserve, and Gus Bolton was it.
That's right.
And he went down to Hamilton, and I joined him there, and he was the first Chief of Staff for Commodore Ken Adams.
That was it, yes. That was it. So we organized that. And then, your next question?
Well, I don't know what else. That's two things.
Well, DCNP is doing everything that CNP has. So everything comes under CNP in the way of training.
Yeah.
All the training right across Canada comes under CNP.
Yeah.
And recruiting, establishments. That CNP has a tremendous amount of things come under him.
Now, sometime, either then or later, you brought into being the Junior Officers Technical and Leadership Course.
Oh, yes.
Was that as DCMP? I think not.
That was when I was CMP.
Yeah.
That's right.
But again, it's training that you had in mind.
Oh, yes. Training came under me entirely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And setting up the schools and the training was entirely mine.
Well, then you were promoted captain. We can come back to your DCMP's time if there's anything occurs to us. You were confirmed as captain on the... And on the 30th of June, 1947, you went to Ontario.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Had a wonderful spot in there.
Yes, well, again, I was in Crescent in those days with John Charles and later with Scruffy O'Brien, and we went to Pearl with you many times.
Oh, good. Good. That was the Trontario was a great ship. It was,
now, you had most of the Uganda ship's company, did you not? She had just paid off.
We had quite a number of Uganda, and I had to remember where the ship's company had all come from, but would you like to hear about the commissioning, joining the Ontario? Is that what you want to hear?
Well, I have a question on Uganda first, which you would remember. Well, I'll ask the question, then you see. You were talking about the political mistake in giving sailors an option. Now, yeah. Uganda was fighting in the Pacific, and she was brought back to dump those that did not volunteer. And there was a great deal of ill feeling about that.
Oh, she voted herself out of the Pacific.
She voted herself out of the Pacific. Have you anything to say about... Now, you got some of these sailors later in Ontario. Yeah. But what about Uganda returning from the Pacific because of that political decision?
Well, I wasn't there the day she arrived back. Or anything. I wasn't there, but that was one of the tragedies. And I've got one of the tragedies of really... You know, my mind goes back to many things, but that was that government decision, to volunteer Pacific, I never understood.
You didn't have any first-hand knowledge of how the sailors felt?
No.
What about the officers? You must have talked to some of them later.
I think, as I told you, when I had to speak to them all seriously in Halifax, I'd had court-martial them if they...
Yeah, but Uganda came back to the West Coast.
Yeah, I didn't see her.
No.
I didn't see her.
Now... So you're captain of Ontario, and you've got
captain of Ontario.
You've got some of Uganda's crew.
Oh, yes, I must have had. That took over that ship. I suppose that brings up the question of when Brock was my commander. He'd been standing by the ship for 6 months, and she'd never been to sea, and never... But the ship was officially recommissioned when I took over captain of her in June 1947. And I was, we were in Esquimalt, and within a few days we went up to the Noose. I've never felt so uncomfortable enjoying the ship. You know, ships had been my life for 30 years, and I had inspected ships as Captain D, and I inspected them as training commander. I went aboard that ship, and for some reason, it didn't seem a happy ship. We went away within a week to Nanoose Bay and anchored in Nanoose to work the ship up. And I'd just taken over command. I hadn't seen her before. And the very first day at Nanoose, the commander came to me as white as a sheet and said, the ship's company had refused to fall in. I think this was at 8 o'clock in the morning.
It was the after lunch, Hanson. Was it 13:15?
Oh, I forget what I have.
I know. I remember that.
Yep. So I said, well, you go to your cabin. All the officers to go to the wardroom. I'll take this on. I'd handled Iroquois a couple of years before, and I said, I'll be the only man to handle this. I got on the loudspeaker myself. This is your captain speaking. Every man is to clear Lord Deck at once. He's to clear Lord Deck and come on the quarter deck. Clear Lord Deck.
Yeah.
All the officers had been sent to the wardroom, the commander to his cabin. I cleared Lord Deck, and I got help from the two padres. They went up and the doors of the mess decks were clipped. And they went up and stood there and helped get them aft. And they came aft pretty damn fast.
Well, they did.
Oh, they came right aft, yes. This is your captain speaking, and you are to come aft. I said, sit down. They all sat on the quarter deck. And I stood at the aft, and there were nearly 1,000 men in that ship.
Yes.
And I let fly. I've never torn a ship's company to pieces the way I had that ship. I said, you are letting down the Canadian Navy, you're letting down Canada. You know what this means. What you're trying to do here, I don't know. I've only been aboard this ship 48 hours. But I tore that group to pieces. And they looked pretty... And then, all of a sudden, at the end of my speech, they stood up and said, three cheers for Ontario. And the ship, three roaring cheers, like that. They went about their work. There'd be no changes in any orders. I then thought I better report this to the Admiral. I got my car and came to Victoria. Mingy was the Admiral.
FOPC, yeah.
And I said, Mingy...
You drove down?
I drove down. Yeah, it's about an hour and a half drive. And I drove down, and I put this on the record since with the archive, because this is a serious thing, just because of the what they call an inquiry into the trouble in the Navy. This is all on record now, but Mingy said to me, we're going to get rid of Brock. And I said, there's no need to that. I can handle that for ship's company. I can handle Brock. He said, no, I have watched Brock here for 6 months, and you know there's no love lost between those two. Brock's book brings this outrage.
Yes, it does.
And I said, I can handle this. Well, no, he said, I think I want to get Brock out. So, the book says, that report that went on in later years, I forget what it was called, the Mingy Report, and that was unfortunate, said that he'd been persuaded to move Brock. Well, Louis Audet says that in his report.
That Mingy was persuaded to remove Brock.
Yes.
Presumably by you.
Yes. I wanted to make it very clear, and I have by regular letter in Ottawa on the archive, that that is not what happened.
You could have handled Brock.
Yeah.
Fine.
And, mind you, it wasn't easy. Brock had a difficult job because he was trying to run a top Navy, and he had some pretty inexperienced officers, too. But anyway, we cleared that up, and Mingy relieved Brock, and I went back to the ship, and looking back, I look ahead 2 years in Ontario, the happiest ship I ever had. I've never known a happier ship.
You went back to the ship, and what happened to Brock?
He was relieved that day.
That day, yeah. By Pat Budge, I think.
Yes, that's right.
A real sailor's commander.
Oh, yeah, great, wonderful man to have had it. Couldn't have had a more wonderful commander to take
what,
him over the ship.
What were the troops complaining about? The reason they locked themselves in the mess days?
They were complaining about many things. Let me just give you examples. They didn't like the commander. That was the first thing. They were complaining about the commander. Mm-hmm. And that in his report later, the commander asked to appear before the Mingy report, and he said, well, you shouldn't replace the commander because the troops don't like him. That's a good point to make.
It is.
Dead right. And so Brock was 100% right, and he should have been replaced. I think we should have cleaned that up the way we cleaned up Iroquois. I knew as soon as I got those fellows into battle, they'd prove themselves. And as soon as I got this ship doing something, these same men would prove themselves.
Yeah.
However, things were happening.
But they didn't like the commander, fine.
They didn't like
what
the commander.
Else?
Well, the orders were very... How do it? Now, in a ship as many people as that, where you have... I had to put the loudspeaker on in my cabin and monitor all the orders that were going to the ship's company. I'd hear things like, hands to dinner. And then the next minute, the first part of starboard watch lay aft, slow awnings. Or next thing I would hear, hands to supper, away, second cutter, first motorboat. These type of things. I mean, there was no sort of tie-in. People can't go from a Corvette to a cruiser.
A hand shouldn't be called out during their meal hours if they're not needed.
There was too much. There was a lot of inexperience in the officers.
Yeah,
very bad. But that ship turned out two of the happiest years I ever had in my life. Beautiful ship, went all over the place.
Yeah.
You were with us when we went to Honolulu, weren't we, in Pearl Harbor and did exercises with the American fleet?
Oh, yes, and down south, too.
Yeah, down to the West Indies, and, we had a great ship.
We always stopped off at Santa Barbara to play cricket, I remember.
Were you at the time we were in San Diego when Admiral Hendren gave that party for the fleet down there?
How do you spell his name?
H-E-N-D-R-E-N, Admiral Hendren. I was looking at something of his the other day, and the officers' club down in San Diego gave a party that ship went on. They brought down three different entertainment groups from Hollywood to entertain us that night. However, go ahead. That's not the part. We had two wonderful years in Ontario. Each winter, we exercised with the American West India Squadron. We went to Guantanamo. We went to what's that base in Mexico in Cuba?
I'll look it up. I've been in there. Magdalena Bay.
No, that's Mexico.
We went into Magdalena Bay.
Oh yes, we exercised the American
Guantanamo.
Now on this,
is it Guantanamo we went into?
Yeah, that's
the USN Naval Base.
I want to bring up. There's a very interesting point here that I think I've gone into on record with. I haven't gone on written anything about this yet, but those days it was considered very against government policy to be seen to be working closely with the Americans. It was not government policy. And I was planning exercises with the American fleet and not telling Ottawa until afterwards. Because I did exercises between San Diego and Panama, exercises in Panama, exercises everywhere with the American fleet when I was going ahead of the Ontario, and you were with me at the time.
Yeah.
And we didn't dare tell Ottawa except to say a note that exercise had been carried out. We couldn't have got approval from Ottawa.
Why was that?
Because the government policy at that time.
But why?
Because they didn't want to be seen to upset the Russians.
Is that why, do you think?
Oh, yes. There was no way were we going to be cooperating with the American fleet. You had people who should know this.
Yeah.
Canadians should know this. Mm. It was quite impossible to get Ottawa to arrange an exercise.
Yeah.
With the Americans. We had to do it alone, locally.
Were there any repercussions after you did it?
Never.
As long as they weren't told, they could say, "Well, we didn't know."
We know about it. I guess that was it. I don't know. I can remember so clearly saying to the Admiral, "We'll tell Ottawa and Washington afterwards."
Yeah, and Menge agreed.
Oh yes,
yeah, of course he did.
Yeah. Oh yes, it was all done locally, and it was.